Everybody, I'm Pete. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober and at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, a sacred place to me. Again, I'd like to thank Chris and the group for this very kind invitation to me to be here with you over the next few weeks. But doing this a while, I've come to find out it's just an invitation to my spirit extended to me by yours. And when it's done that way, we're able to be joined together with the common peril and hold together with the common solution. And as our book says, we commence to walk shoulder to shoulder our common journey. When I have found when people meet on this path, there's something that we get excited about, even though it may disturb us. There's something that is sacred about it, even though it may disturb us. If you haven't been excited about doing this work yet, I hope over the next few weeks you will. I hope even that I disturb a few. It's all to the good. It's kind of like shaking up to wake up, and we discover new obstacles in our path as we move along. If you're attending any, my experience has been if you're attending any sort of deal like this and the whole weekend is really smooth sailing, you're not paying attention, or maybe the speakers need to go home and do more homework. This is about, you know, taking a look at new things and having an open mind with it. I'll share this again, as I hope to remember every week. The ego will answer and bypass truth. When you want to ask a question or have a comment, the ego will defend itself throughout the next few weeks. It will fight for its life because it may have a chance of dying. Different manifestations of self will arise during the next few weeks, and they will fight for their life because they may die. Self, what is blocking us from experiencing this power, will get in the way over and over and over again. And it'll come in the form of contempt, pride, investigation. This guy does not know what he's talking about. I don't agree with what he has to say. This is new. I've never done a fourth step this way. I never saw a chapter more about alcohol in that way. He's too arrogant. He's too opinionated. It'll go on and on and on, because I've experienced all of that stuff. And what the thinking mind will do to you is take you to get a drink. But first, it will pretty up a junkyard. And it'll damage any information that may save my life. It has to. So what I like to, I would like to throw out some some considerations for us to think about as we move along. Tonight we're going to be finishing up chapter 2, and God willing, finishing up chapter 3, and we're going to be talking a whole lot about the mind and the thinking mind. And what I've shared with you guys over the last couple of weeks is, let's also, for some of us, think about where we are now, currently. Where am I currently, tonight with this work, this past week with this work? How am I doing right now? How was it on my way over here? How's it going to be when I get home tonight? Am I going to do it? Do I have a meditative life when I get in the house tonight? Am I taking these principles into my home occupation affair around 10 o'clock tonight? How am I doing? Am I living in the present moment? Am I now, here, current? Am I holding on to befores and waiting for later ons and using now as just a means to an end? How am I doing? Some of us have been through this work a whole bunch of times, and we're in 10 and 11 and working with disciplines, and so why am I here? Maybe not with the same desperation of a drowning man to stay away from the next drink as we do when we first came in here, but maybe currently there's some things that are new obstacles in my path to having an experience with this power, a new experience, this power for me to be current, to be free, to experience bliss. So how am I doing now? So I bring this work up to where I am and let it meet me where I am. One of the things I always like to talk about is the thinking mind, and what's it like when no one's around, and how's my mind doing? What I have found out is when the thought life stops, I become awake to the present moment. When the thought life stops, I experience no mind. I've shared this a million times. There was a saying on a commercial, mind is a terrible thing to waste, and I found out in here it's a wonderful thing to waste. It's the only thing it's going to do is cause me being blocked from the sunlight of the spirit. How? Because I get so identified with what my mind tells me. And I'm not only talking about, Pete, it's a good idea to go drink because, and you fill in the blank like when we're new, and we're in that state of obsession, but alcoholism goes underground when we're here a little while and starts to wake up and resurfaces in other areas, and my thinking mind will want to get me back there, eventually back to a drink. It will take me away from the sunlight of the spirit. So what's my mind doing? It's constantly, it's obsessive, it's compulsive, it's badgering me constantly, on me all the time. And I usually know when I'm out of it when I go, wow, I'm back. I'm driving down the road and my mind's going in 80 different directions, and then all of a sudden I take a deep breath and go, okay, I'm back. When thought life stops, when that thinking mind stops, I experience no mind, which means I experience peace and stillness, right? You ever notice that when you're paying attention to the silence between someone's words, that you're present? When you're working with someone and there's no distractions and you're there in spirit and not in mind, you're awake to the present moment. No mind equal peace and stillness. No mind equal total presence, which equals freedom. And we can apply that to when we're first coming in here and we're getting hit from every angle and it's coming down on us from every angle, and on top of everything, we're trying to fight off this obsession to drink alcohol, and you know we're going to lose because we're blocked from the sunlight of the spirit. But again, currently, how am I doing? How's my thinking life doing? How's my thought life? Our big book uses the word thought life, thinking mind, many times. How's that? How are we doing with that? As we move along and we get into more about alcoholism, and you may be thinking about it now because I've talked about God a whole lot up until this point and having an experience with this power. One of the things we tend to do, I know I did and still do, is we have a relationship. We start to have a relationship with this power. Call it whatever you want, God, whatever. But this power. And in developing this relationship, which is all good, we tend to, as I did, conceptualize it, which is kind of a normal flow of things. I have an idea about what my God really is about. It's very delicate, but there it is. I have a relationship, and I start to get an idea of what my God is about. Good so far, except with that comes, and it's subtle, I start to, with my conception of my God, I start to, little by slowly, box this power in. Because I am so limited. So I can say, well, God's all loving. Well, that's based on what I know of love. God's all forgiving. Well, that's based on what I know of forgiving. I can go out into the road here and look about three blocks down, and then it starts to get blurry. My God can see way past that. So all my decisions are based on my limited vision, my limited experience. So even though we start to have this relationship with this power, and we start to conceptualize it, all good, but we need to be really careful how quickly we box it in. And then we start to think, the question was asked to me recently, are you fearful of picking up a drink? Well, yeah, of course I am, because it's going to bring back the horror show again. I know that. I don't know where exactly I'm going to wind up, but it's going to be horrific. And the question was turned to me, well, isn't God's grace keeping you sober? I says, yes. He said, why are you afraid? And I had to take a look at, okay, have I little by slowly taken some responsibility for me being separated or not? I haven't, but it was certainly food for thought, and had to open up my little bit slowly putting God in a box again. All I do here is some work that takes me to this power, which has already been keeping me sober all along. In the hallway in 1988, I was separated and have been separated. And I got to a place, the bitter end that our book talks about, where there are no lurking notions, no reservations, no attachments, nothing, and I begged for help and I was separated, God willing, for the last time. And over the last 16 years, I have demonstrated some behaviors as a member of AA that should have gotten me drunk. And I've experienced some wonderful things and have accomplished some wonderful things. The old behavior said, well, now let's go celebrate about this. And I should have gotten drunk. Never did. In fact, the thought of a drink has never crossed my mind. So it's this God, this power that has kept me separated. So when the question was asked, are you afraid of picking up a drink? My mind went to, yeah, because I'll buy back this. And what my sponsor was getting at was, who's keeping you sober? And if God's keeping you sober, why fear? My book tells me we will outgrow fear, won't we? So I guess fear may not be a good enough motivator to keep me sober. So just some stuff to sit with. If I'm already disturbing you, good. We'll have a good meeting. One of the things we tend to do with the thinking mind is, I've done it just umpteen times, put such great expectations. My mind puts such incredibly high expectations on people. And little by slowly, I turn people into godlike. And when things don't go my way, God becomes humanlike. What do I mean? Well, you should perform to these high standards, including me. And God forbid if you don't, I get really angry with you because you fell short, as we all do, but I can't see that in my thinking mind. I hold you to the highest standards. When things don't go my way, I look at God as this rewarding God. God, I did my inventory, I prayed, I meditated, I helped others, where's my piece of the pie? And then I think he's not listening to me. I get angry with him. He's not really what I thought he was, and I turn God into one of us, full of fault. And it happens that quick. So where am I in my relationship with this God? Am I willing to live on terms other than mine? Very easy to write my life script and say, okay, God, follow. I'm the director, you follow. I know you're the director, but right now I'm going to be the director, you follow the script. And then I become frustrated. And little by slowly, I start to experience some current agnosticism, and my mind will never tell me that. I'm just running on some self-reliance, and I wonder why I'm experiencing fear. Every time I turn a corner, I'm in fear again. Thinking mind, the wonderful thing to lose. Turn in, I work with a word called turn. Turn to the power. And disidentify with my thinking mind, and that is work, that's practice. Thing I was working with, and still do, is something this author Eckhart Tolle talks about, is watching the thinker, witness to my own thoughts. Instead of my thinking mind using me, I'll use it when I want and be a witness to what's going on. Just watch it in action. Just pay attention to it. Watch it. Don't fight it, because then we create struggle and turmoil. And trying to be still, we're creating struggle. Just watch the thinking mind, what it's doing. Look, like another person, look at this. Look what it's doing. Chapter 2, we last left off on There's a Solution. And where a gentleman named Roland Hazard meets Carl Jung, Dr. Carl Jung. And I'd just like to go to page 25. Last paragraph says, if you are seriously alcoholic as we were, and that's to turn a statement into question, am I experiencing body, mind, and spirit? Obsession, phenomenon of craving, and a spirit that's blocked. We believe there's no middle-of-the-road solution, and we talked about a middle-of-the-road solution. Any kind of information that doesn't give me direction to have a spiritual experience is a middle-of-the-road solution, like double up on your meetings or make 90 meetings in 90 days and things like that. Make more coffee. We're in a position where life was becoming impossible, and if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had two alternatives. Step one, to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. And for me, that meant drink myself to death. And the other, to accept spiritual help, and that was step two. This we did because we honestly wanted to and willing to make the effort. And circumstances for me what brought me to a place of willingness. Being at the bitter end, being brought to death's door, were the circumstances that turned me to this power. And I haven't looked back. Page 26. A certain American businessman had ability, good sense, and high character. For years he had floundered from one sanitarium to another. And this is Roland Hazard. He had consulted the best-known American psychiatrist. Then he had gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of a celebrated physician, Dr. Carl Jung, who prescribed for him. Though experience made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. Now, I remember leaving rehab feeling really confident, and as soon as I hit the fresh air, my mind said, we can go drink now. I put on weight, I exercised, I was eating and sleeping, and I felt really good about me. I knew my triggers, I knew my issues, and so I'm never going to pick up a drink again. And then I hit the fresh air. And on my way to the Long Island Railroad, suddenly the thought crossed my mind that that liquor store down the block, I should go celebrate. I just did 28 days in rehab. His physical and mental condition were unusually good. Above all, he believed he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind. A sick mind, the self-imposed crisis. A sick mind cannot heal a sick mind. My sick mind can't fix a sick mind. I'm using a sick mind to do the right thing, to stay away from a drink. The only thing my mind's going to do is cause me more problems and take me back to a drink. So here's Roland relying on a sick mind to stay away from a drink. And knowledge, thinking, he's thinking knowledge is going to fix him, is going to cure him. And we all know about knowledge. A great example, I was sober a short time. I met a gentleman who was in and out of these rooms for 7 years. He could read you this book forwards and backwards, had a wealth of knowledge, but couldn't stay away from a drink. And I wondered why God put that guy in my life, and I learned a great lesson from his horror story, that knowledge without experience is like basically studying, you know, reading a book and putting it back on the shelf. We need, remember I talked about, are you experienced? Are we having an experience with the information in this book? And he says, a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs. I hear that as his issues and his triggers and everything else. That relapse was unthinkable. Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short time. More baffling still, he could give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. I get out of rehab after 9 weeks of being separated. I get out on Saturday. I'm drunk on Monday and wondering, how did that happen? How did this happen? See, the problem with using the mind to think the drink through, like you'll hear, play the tape to the end, think the drink through, is that they forgot to tell you, what about the strange mental blank spot? Oh, they forgot that part. So he returned to Dr. Carl Jung, who he admired, and asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational, well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet he had no control whatever over alcohol. And he begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth. Page 27. The doctor said, second paragraph, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one single case recover where that state of mind, I'd like you to underline state of mind, existed to the extent that it does in you. Next sentence says, is there no explanation, Roland replies, and the doctor says, yes, there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have what I call vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are a phenomenon. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. And this kind of parallels what we talked about, the great fact on page 25. There's a shift that happens for us. It's done for us when we wake up. It says, in fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement within you. With many individuals, circle the word individuals here, The methods which I employed are successful, and there's a really good chance those individuals were not real alcoholics. That's why he was successful with it. He says, but I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description, and I like you to underline alcoholic of your description, because he's talking about us now. So one of the greatest minds, with all the information he gave Roland still got drunk. Roland knew, he felt he knew about the inner workings of his mind. He had acquired some knowledge. He had acquired some confidence. Sat with one of the greatest minds ever, and Roland gets drunk on his way back to the States. Upon hearing this, our friend was somewhat relieved, for he reflected that, after all, he was a good church member. His hope, however, was destroyed by the doctors telling him, while his religious convictions were very good, in this case, they did not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience. Knowledge, spiritual beliefs, rituals, practices are different than having an experience with the power that we're given rituals to and worshiping, etc. Having an experience is different than that. So I can be a good church member or attend the religion of my choice and do all the practices they talk about. I could light candles, incense, do all of it. All good. But it may not be, it's different than having an experience with this power, which is what I'm seeking, an experience. And he uses the words here, vital, life-giving, or even life-threatening spiritual experience. Here we're talking about life-giving. It's that important. It says on page 28, we in turn sought the same escape with all the desperation of a drowning man. And I turn that into a question. Am I seeking this power with the desperation of a drowning man? Or have I gotten comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous? What had seemed first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us. It's been given us. It's been given to us. Okay? Or if you prefer a designed living that really works. Chapter 3. As we go through this, we're going to be talking about the mind. And remember, the mind will take me back to that which is killing me over and over and over again. It doesn't have mercy. Alcoholism does not have mercy, and that's been my experience. A couple of things we want to pay attention to here is the title of this chapter. I'd like you to circle the word more, because if you didn't get it yet, we're going to talk more about alcoholism. And we're going to specifically pay attention to the mind. Okay, some words we want to pay attention to also is illusion, delusion, smash, and concede. Illusion is outside of my body, like watching a magician perform a magic trick. I watch people drink and I think I can drink like them. It's magic. They're having three or four and they're still talking to the girl next to them and they're going home and paying the rent this month and they're working. So I can drink like them. Delusion is inside my mind. Will tell me to pick up the drink after being separated and getting out of jail or rehab. Delusion is inside. Smash is basically to obliterate, to break into pieces. I'm going to talk about that. And concede is to submit under pressure. Concede, it says, to our innermost self that we're alcoholics is the first step. When that happens, that's a spiritual thing when we get to that place where deep down in here we concede to our innermost self, I, Pete Marinelli, am an alcoholic. I need help. Not to say it because I'm in rehab, but it's the right thing to say at a meeting. When you know when that happens, that moment of clarity where we concede, we submit, it's done over. That's a spiritual thing when that happens. The hook is it may not be enough to get me to a place of recovery. It may get me here to rehab. It certainly has made me open enough. There's an open about the window of opportunity, if you will. Most times that window gets slammed shut when people talk to us about God. And sadly, we don't talk enough about God in Alcoholics Anonymous because we're fearful we may scare the newcomer out. The great thing about talking about God is if we can share directions on how to get there, how we have experienced this power. Okay. Page 30 says, most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. I'd like you to circle the word unwilling and real because our book separates us. It says of this type, of our kind, real alcoholic, they separate us over and over and over again. The reason why I'm unwilling is we use a nice word like denial, and what it really is because I'm in a state of delusion. okay, no person likes to think he is bodily, and that's the phenomenon of craving, and mentally, and that's the exception to alcohol, different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove I could drink like other people. The moderate drinker doesn't do this. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The moderate drinker doesn't try to control and enjoy. We have to because we can't. I can't control and enjoy. State of obsession. Moderate drinkers drink or don't drink. Drink a little, go home. They don't do this. They're not in a state of obsession over the next drink. That's been my experience. Many of us pursue this illusion to the gates of insanity or death. One of the assignments I remember doing, my sponsor would give me some work to do to help have an experience with this book, is I took the statement, the idea, somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking, is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. What did that mean to me? What was my book trying to tell me? And I wrote out, as I did many passages in this book, my interpretation of that. And what it allowed me to do was, again, touch part of my first step. See how many times I would try to drink like my kid brothers. I would try to drink like some family members. I would try to drink like some guys at the bar watching Monday Night Football, have a few beers and go home, and they had to, like, throw me out. What was the difference? It said we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. And without this place where we submit, the other 11 steps become an impossible task because you can't build on a lie. So therefore, we spend a few weeks in step one for this reason. Am I convinced I'm a real alcoholic? It says the delusion or the lie that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. The idea that I'm like someone else before the drink and while I'm drinking has to be smashed. I am not. The idea that I'm right now tonight at 8:40 like other people also has to be smashed. Sober 16 years, I am not. Our book talks about being rocketed into the fourth dimension, meaning I'm no longer plagued by obsessions, compulsions, and my emotions. If I'm experiencing that now, I'm not like other people. Here's why. Because if I don't do anything about it, little by slowly, I will become blocked from this power, which is vital for me not only stay away from a drink, for me to live sober. You with me? I need to seek this power to overcome that stuff. Other people, civilians, can do what they do. They live in a place of resentment. They steal from their neighbor. May not be living pleasant lives, but they're not throwing their life away over Jack Daniels. They're not in a state of obsessional compulsion over the next drink. They're doing what they do. I solve my problems through drink. Now I solve my problems through spirit. So I'm not like other people currently. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. My morals were taken to a place beyond what I could ever think they would be taken to. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type, circle our type, are a progressive illness over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. And there's some words that are interchangeable here. They just use the word control. I'm going to read this again. It says, we alcoholics, our men and women, have lost the power of choice in our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers choice. All of us felt at times we were regaining choice, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less choice, or you could use the word power, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. No power, no choice, and no control. They're interchangeable for our first step. Our next page talks about using every form of self-deception and experimentation to prove we're not real alcoholics. And one of the things I did was I listed on a piece of paper how many ways I tried to control, regulate, or stop my drinking. Drink on the weekends, drink only in the morning, drink in the afternoon. I won't drink Blackberry Brandy. I'll go back to Jack Daniels. I'll try Bacardi. That seems like a nice one. And I'll go back to Southern Comfort. You know, that'll make me regulate. It's really harsh stuff. And I mean, you name it, I tried it. Money, no money. Put money, you know, in an envelope and leave it on my dresser drawer. I tried leaving money one time with the co-worker and banging on his door at 3 o'clock in the morning, give me my money back. I told the guy, I'll use a fake name. I says, Bill, here's money. We got paid. Take this because I'm going to spend it, and I don't want to. I'm putting like 40 bucks in my pocket, and I'm not lying to you. It was close to 3 a.m. I'm banging, ringing this guy's door, banging on his door. He came to the door and just looked at me like, what is this? Give me my money. It's my money. So I do things like that. Never worked. The end result of me trying to stop, control, or regulate my drinking was I got drunk because I was using me and my mind to overcome me and my mind. One of the greatest things that came out of going through the work last time in my seventh step was Father saved me from me, because I will do me in faster than anyone. You with me? Bottom of page 31. One little piece I want to pay attention to. It says, we do not like to pronounce any individual as alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. So this is an illness that we have that we diagnose ourselves based on some of the considerations in our big book. Page 33. The story prior to what we're going to read on 33 talks about a gentleman who was separated for 25 years, and after 25 years, his mind told him he could celebrate and pick up a drink, and he died in 4. Because alcohol doesn't care how long we're separated from it. It progresses as we're sober. So if I'm sober now 16 years, and God forbid I pick up a drink, in a short time I'm as bad as ever, it's like my illness never stopped. And that's what that story relates to. So the delusion is, well, I've been separated for this, I made 90 meetings in 90 days, so I can have a drink, it won't be that bad. I've been sober this long, maybe I can have a drink, it won't be that bad. And we start thinking like that, we will drink, because we are totally blocked from the sunlight of the Spirit. There's no choice. I don't decide when I'm going to pick up a drink. The illness does, and if I'm blocked from the Spirit, I'm drinking. That's powerless over the thinking mind. It says on page 31, it says, first paragraph about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sentences down, it says, we have seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are in a short time as bad as ever. If we are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol. They talk about in the next paragraph, they use the words peculiar mental tryst already acquired that keeps me from putting my hand on a hot stove. A hot stove I'm real careful about. When it comes to alcohol, there's this peculiar mental tryst that says it won't burn this time. The drink won't kill me this time. I won't lose my family this time. I won't wind up in jail again this time. I won't experience incomprehensible demoralization again. There's parallel with our sound reasoning, it's going to tell us there runs some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. There has to be an insane excuse for taking the first drink. Why would we? Another reason why there is no choice, there is no power, and there is no control before we pick up a drink. Page 34. Second paragraph, it says, for those who are unable to drink moderately, sounds like us, the question is how to stop altogether. And I like you to circle the word altogether, forever. Oh, it's only a day at a time. Well, that's my human condition, but my spirit doesn't wear a watch. Dr. Bob talked about in his story, quit drinking for good and all. So I will sit with a new guy and I'll tell him, if you're at that place, I can promise you, you never have to pick up a drink again, and you get a look like a deer in the headlights, because they've been hearing contemporary AA. a day at a time, this hanging in there, a day at a time. My book tells me something different. Stop altogether, Dr. Bob says, for good and all. Why would God keep me in a place of bondage where I have to keep a drink away from me every single day? You know I'm losing. But God removes that from us. It tells me in step 10, when placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected, it just comes. That's the miracle of it. I'm free. Back to what I opened up with. Who's keeping Pete Marinelli sober? Peter or God? And if God is, why am I afraid? It says we are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Take that statement, turn it into a question. If I'm around here a while, do I have a desire to continue to grow in understanding and effectiveness? Lay aside old ideas for a new experience with this power. Whether such a person, important stuff, whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he or she has already lost the power to choose, circle that word, whether they will drink or not. If you can quit upon a non-spiritual basis, you do the sober softball team deal, make coffee, and go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and your life is together, I tip my hat to you. Great. That's great. But the real alcoholic is getting drunk on just that stuff. I've seen it, demonstrated, shown to me over and over again, including my own life. There's sobriety in the coffee pot. Go to an AA sober dance. It'll keep you sober. For how long? A couple of hours, maybe. But it's insufficient. It's a middle-of-the-road solution. It won't take me to a place to have an experience with this power so I can get to a podium and say I'm recovered and free and experience some bliss, awake to the present moment. The sober dance, joining sober softball, making 90 meetings in 90 days, which our founding members never did, won't work for me now. It was about having an experience with this power. So a moderate hard drinker doesn't need to go to the lengths that some of us need to do and go to. Great story was told to me. A bunch of guys at a meeting joined the sober softball team. There were a couple of big book guys and a couple of regular AA guys in there. A few years later, the guys who were doing the book got drunk and those other guys stood sober. I said, well, how did that happen? Because the real alcoholics were in the book, walked away from the book, got blocked from the sunlight of the spirit, and sober softball was insufficient and they got drunk. The moderate hard drinkers were walking around in AA meetings saying they're real alcoholics and or alcoholics of this type were doing that type of conventional recovery and they were still sober. They didn't need a vital spiritual experience. And the first week I begged, if you're a real alcoholic, make sure your sponsor, from my experience, is a real alcoholic. Because if you're a real alcoholic and your sponsor is a hard or moderate drinker who doesn't need a vital spiritual experience, they will tell you from the bottom of their heart, make 90 meetings in 90 days, double up on your meetings, and let's join the sober softball team, and let's make coffee, all neat things. And then you get drunk, or maybe, God forbid, die. And then that sponsor says, well, he didn't want it enough. With me? Okay. It says, many of us felt we have plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. Back to, I can make lots of sweet promises. I cannot stop the drink when it's on me. I cannot stop the state of obsession when it's on me. And once I'm in the allergy, I can't stop until it tells me I'm stopping. That's powerlessness. No matter how great the necessity or the wish, our book talks about fraud, the emotional appeal. Families begging us, pleading with us. Employer, policeman, whoever it may be. Okay. We're going to skip over to page 35. We're going to talk about this guy Jim. And it says, this man is a charming, has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. And he has this commendable World War record. He's a good salesman. Everybody likes this guy. He's intelligent. normal so far as we can see, except for this nervous disposition. And so this guy has this really neat little business that was given to him and a really nice reputation. Alcoholism really doesn't care. He did no drinking until he was 35, and in a few years he became so violent when intoxicated he had to be put in a rehab or detox or an asylum. And then he came in contact with some AA people. It says in the next paragraph, we told them what we knew of alcohol. They probably told him about the body and the mind. And the answer they had found, step two, he made a beginning. What happens? His family's reassembled. He began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drink, and I'd like you to underline that. Because now this guy is working for the place he owned. If you're an alcoholic, you're having a little bit of an experience with a resentment. Okay. It says all went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge, I like it underline this, failed to enlarge his spiritual life. He wasn't having the necessary vital spiritual experience. May have taken step one, maybe even had a consideration for step two, and he was done. It says, to his consternation, he found himself, and I like it underlined this, drunk half dozen times in rapid succession. Spree remorse, spree remorse, spree remorse, spree remorse. And these people kept working with him. It says, on each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic. So in a sense, he conceded he was a real alcoholic in a serious condition. And he knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family, for which he had deep affection. Page 36, though, says he got drunk again. So again, sufficient reason to stop was insufficient. It says, yet he got drunk again. And we asked him to tell exactly what happened. Now remember, this guy is working for a place that he owned. He's a worker, not a boss. He's coming off of six consecutive drunks. He says, I came to work on Tuesday morning and I attended a workshop where they always, I remember them bringing this out, where was this guy on Monday? I don't know. Was he drinking, you know, nursing a hangover? Where was he? I remember he says, I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. So he's coming off of six drunks, he's coming to work on Tuesday, and he has a resentment that he's working for a place that he owned. He's not in a good spiritual place. So here, what this story does, they're going to set up, they have the setup and the ambush. Is the only way I can put this, what alcoholism does. It's a setup and the ambush. And watch what happens. He says, I had a few words with the boss. As I heard someone else say it, he probably said, Jim, where were you yesterday? But nothing serious. Then I decided to drive into the country to see one of my prospects for a car. So far, so good. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. Now, for a civilian, that sounds pretty safe. Even for a moderate drinker, I know this place, they have a bar, I'm going to try to kick up some business. Sounds pretty safe. Here's a guy who's in a resentment, got to work a day late, six drunks in a row, and his mind says, oh, we know that place, Jim's Bar and Grill. We're going to have some lunch and maybe get a prospect to make some business. His mind is not going to tell him, there's a bar, we shouldn't go. He's going to say, I know about the bar, but there's food in the back. Set up. So what does he do? He says, I ate there many times. Here's the mental thing that goes on. You know, I vaguely sense I wasn't being too smart, that type of stuff, which they're going to talk about. He says, I sat down at a table, ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. Why would his illness tell him, hey, Jim, we're going to get drunk today? It just shows up. He says, I ordered a sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. And here it comes. Suddenly, is the insanity, and it's quick. Vaguely is that quiet voice, and it's slow. And if I'm not awake, I'll never hear that quiet voice. He didn't. It was kind of like a glitch on the radar. He paid attention to suddenly, which is the illness. He said, suddenly, squiggly writing, the thought italics, somebody taught me that here, italics. The thought crossed my mind that if I would put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. So what does he do? he couldn't see suddenly coming. He goes with it. He has no input into the decision that's made for him. So he orders. He says, I vaguely sense I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking whiskey on a full stomach. Let's just shoot back to page 24 for a moment, please. First paragraph. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory and suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago, or in Jim's case, the last six drunks. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences, and that's the vaguely he experienced, that follow taking even a glass of beer or putting whiskey and milk, don't crowd into my mind to deter Jim or me. If they occur, they're hazy and readily supplanted, but this time I'm going to handle myself like other people. That's the insanity. And that's what he experienced. And what does he say on the bottom of the page? Thus started one more journey to the asylum or to rehab or to detox for Jim. He had the threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of the intense mental or physical suffering which drinking always caused him. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic. And what did he do? It was pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he can mix it with milk. It tells me great words here. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. Step two tells me I'm being restored to sanity, which means I must be insane somewhere, and that's before I pick up a drink. Not the things I do when I'm on a drunk in the allergy. That's drunk and in the allergy. But the insanity for me as an alcoholic that I have to be taken from is I haven't had a drink. I've been in rehab for 9 weeks. I haven't had a drink in 9 weeks. I'm separate, I feel good. I've made 90 meetings in 90 days. I'm sober 6 months. Whatever it is, however it sets up, I can drink now. You'll hear this. I went out on a relationship. I wish I had a dollar for every time I heard what happened. I went out on a relationship. She left me. He left me. And my response is, as I've been taught, were you drinking during the relationship or any relationship? Yeah. So you didn't go out on the relationship. I went out because I lost my job and I'm going bankrupt. Did you drink when you had money or were employed? Yeah. So it's not that, is it? Probably a real alcoholic who hasn't had a vital spiritual experience. Are we experienced? Are we having one? Because alcoholism, in my experience has been, doesn't care how long I'm separated from it. It'll wait. Okay. And, Lord, we're at 9 o'clock. Page 37. It says, you may think this an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched, but this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences. I like it underlined, this next statement. But there was always the curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. And the next day we would ask ourselves, or others would ask us, what happened? And I can never come up with a good reason based on where drinking took me in the past. Back in Doctor's Opinion, they talk about how the real alcoholic, how we are drinking to overcome a craving beyond our mental control. Not to escape, not to feel good, not as a social lubricant where I'm at a party, I just kind of want to loosen up a little bit, or I had a tough day, I need a couple of drinks. We're drinking to overcome a desire beyond the mental control. And once we're in the allergy, I can't stop. The social moderate hard drinker has a few, gets drunk, goes home. Me, I don't know where I'm winding up once I'm in the allergy. And my mind will take me back there over and over again. It's almost 9:05, and so I like to always throw it open to the floor for any questions or comments at this time. So thanks for listening. Questions, comments. something I said. Mm-hmm. Okay. Hi. Hi. Thank you. Uh-huh. Thank you. Thank you. Anyone questions? Any comments? Okay. Hi.
Hey, Mary. Mm-hmm. We're not spiritually fit, and we're new in the program. We're going to drink if we think that they're good. And is that what you mean when you say, you know, don't be saying think mm-hmm. they're good. Don't be saying 90 minutes or 90 mm-hmm. days, because we can mm-hmm. still drink in 90 days.
So the question is, what do I mean by don't think to drink through because you'll drink and I need to have a vital spiritual experience? And I'll base that on what I've witnessed and including my own experience. If I start to cut corners, for lack of a better term, on my meditative life, on my inventory life, on my prayer life, little by slowly, I will get blocked from the sunlight of the spirit. I will not be awake. My ego will tell me I'm awake, but I'm sound asleep in Alcoholics Anonymous. And behavior starts to change. The shift that woke me up, it will be a shift to put me to sleep again, and I will be unaware of it. And my alcoholism will go underground and resurface in other areas. I talked about the food spree, the sex spree, the anger spree, the fear spree. It will show up like that. And fear will be really the catalyst behind all of it. And little by slowly, I will get to a place where those solutions no longer work. And I become so blocked from this spirit that the only thing I have to do is my old solution is drink. And I get into a state of obsession. And then someone tells me, think it through. And I'm relying on my sick mind to think it through to the end. Well, you know what? It may work once in a while. Am I willing to even take that gamble if it does work once in a while? Because what I'm really doing is putting one bullet in a chamber and spinning it and seeing if I come up, good or bad. Because that's what we're doing. And my experience has been any time I've done that, my illness has gone on the ground and resurfaced. And if it wasn't a call for help, you have a different speaker here tonight. So thinking the drink through, my experience has been, and what I've witnessed by others, most times people get drunk on that because who sits in a state of obsession and think, well, let me figure this out. If I go to the deli and get a six-pack, I'm probably going to lead to another six-pack. Then I'm going to call up Flacco and get that other stuff. And I probably won't make it home. Then I'll be drinking in an after-hours joint, and then I'm going to lose my job. So I really don't want to drink. So doesn't that imply choice? If I walk away from it when I don't have choice. You'll hear in AA, take the easier, softer way. And that has gotten so gobbled and watered down that the easier, softer way is don't do any of this work. I 6 months in here, my first 6 months not doing any of this work, and it was work, trying to just stay away from it. It was horrible. My behavior did not demonstrate someone on this path. This is the easier, softer way because it's done for us. We have guidelines. We have directions. We experience God. This is the easier, softer way. So back to your question. Thinking it through is not a successful method for me because I got drunk on it. I try to think through other behaviors and act it out. Emerging remorseful with the firm resolution, I'm not doing it again. So I'm using a sick mind to overcome a sick mind. And I will never tell the newcomer, think it through, play the tape through. I won't do it. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Yes?
because of being recovering, I feel like it's a similar point. And, you know, I always feel like myself as this, like, really more intellectual, you know, complex thing going on. And as I'm finding out, as I get further into the program, that it's simple. And, you know, you're talking about the explanation I want to say, you know, when I try to think things through, do things in my recovery, my life, in so many, even in church recovery, right? If I try to think of it, I mess up. But when I ask God to help me, it works. And this is what I'm saying. Like, you know, you said, a mind of wonderful thing for me. And it's things like that, that helps me, you know, like these little quick, like I would, you know, go off in long discourse, thinking how I figured it out. And you said it was five years ago. And I want to thank you for that. And that's like something, you know, I can remember them too.
Gotcha.
I thought it was like very intellectual, and in fact, also 5 or 7 helped me more than all my thinking ever helped me for the last 4 years. So, thank you.
Thank you. Here's this example of the difference between thinking it through and God doing for me what I can't do for myself. Last summer, I go into a deli to get some shopping done, and there's a gentleman checking out with a six-pack of beer. It was a hot summer day, and he put the beer on the counter. And as God's my witness, I looked at them and I said, I know what that brings. It was just a couple. I looked at the beer. I says, I just knew where that was taking me. There was no, the sweating, the dripping, cold beer on a hot day. There was none of that stuff. Oh, let me think it through. I saw them, and it was done for me. I was put in a position of neutrality, safe and protected, with no effort, no thought on my part. I need to stress that. No thought or effort on my part. It was done for me. Step 10 promise. I paid for my groceries and got out of there and wondered where that guy was going to wind up. Was he just a social drinker, or was he going to disappear for a week? That's the difference. Out of time? No?
Yeah.
Hi.
Welcome.
You like me to explain what they mean by daily reprieve contingent on a spiritual maintenance?
No, I think I know what they mean. I just, that was a big concept. And they are written there. And yet you talk about the big, you know, the neutrality forever for the rest of our lives.
Yes. Okay, great question. That's my human condition. I live a day at a time. That's my human condition. But as I said, my spirit, and this I speak for myself, my God doesn't live by the clock. He doesn't go to sleep. He doesn't wake up. He doesn't take a coffee break, because I'll die on that. My spirit's able to be and just is. My condition is I do this deal, this earth life, a day at a time. That's why our book is just touched by the spirit, because they talk to us and meet us wherever we are. One more. Thank you. Just a suggestion for whatever this is worth. Do not be attached to the outcome of doing this. In the back. Hi.
Hey, Pat.
was the only kind of work that was going to serve up my ego. I didn't realize that at the time, but it came over me incredibly, like it was a war. And like I was on my way to a fifth step, it was like, by the time I got here, I wanted to kill someone. And I was like, what's happening? I left, I'm going to, and then something that happened was happening all the time. I realized that it was getting served up, and it didn't want to die. And it was just going wild. And today, I still feel that tug a little bit when I'm going, like, but, you know, casually, like, I want to go here, or I want to do this. And I'm aware of that. That's my ego. I got caught up with, you know, you get a lot of people coming in here, and you know, they can stop on their own power. You know, they stop drinking for years, they stop using, they come hang out here, they like the social, they like hanging out with us alcohol for some reason. And, you know, if I get tied up with working, then all of a sudden I'm in a spiritual arm wrestling match for like a couple of months, and it's like, what am I doing here? You know, and I realize that they're not in a hopeless society. And if they're halfway through work, or in a, fight and argue, then my ego gets attached to that. And there's times where I have to turn around and say, God, just like, go in peace. Like, and it's sometimes I feel I have to say, hopeless with that, there's other issues here. But it's not the issue that a hopeless alcoholic that I have, but I have a disease attached to my head. That, that only a spiritual psychic change could help me. But the other stuff I gotta separate my ego from, whatever I could hear the past so I get caught up in that. Sometimes I decide to say, go to people. There's other people that can help you. Like the softball team or whatever. Whatever you're here for, I have no idea why you have your own power. You know, you have a nice year, all of a sudden, you start coming back. I would be here if I didn't have to, But I get caught in that. But yeah, I'm really caught up on the field because I mean, a living, breathing organism that tries to kill me every time. But the truth is, by killing me, it tries to pass stuff on the weirdest thing. But thank you. You have to bring that to life.
Thank you. Are we out of time? One more?
Hi.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hi, Sarah.
I lost you. Can you just, I'm sorry, can you speak up? So I'd like to share the question with the room, that's why. How do I know if I have enough spiritual fitness, and is it evident by if I have another day of sobriety? Is it shown up in that way? That's God's deal. I don't sit back with a scorecard and say, okay, I'm spiritually fit today. If I'm experiencing fear, because thank the good Lord, I haven't experienced the thought of a drink in quite some time. But I do nightly reviews, and I show a full show and thought, word, and deed every day. But if I'm having an experience with fear, or am I living in fear? Am I having an experience with anger, or am I living with anger? Am I having an experience with lust, or am I living in lust? Am I experiencing or living in that place? How am I doing? My inventories and discussing with others will reveal to me immediately where I'm at. But the flip side is, the more inventory I do, and the more I reveal with myself, obstacles are cast aside, the things that are blocking me from this power. So although, that's why they talk about reconstructively review our day, because I'm seeing where I'm falling short in thought, word, and deed, but in that I'm growing, rather than letting it hide and little by slowly block me from this power. So I don't put me on a scorecard saying, today I'm really spiritually fit, and tomorrow or yesterday I wasn't. My actions demonstrate to me where I'm at. But more importantly, I will let you judge where you think I'm at. Let my family judge if I'm on this path or not. They'll tell you. You know, my girlfriend will tell you, my dad will tell you, my family members will tell you, my boss will tell you. Members in AA who see me outside of here will certainly tell you when I'm stuck in traffic how I'm doing. Yeah. Am I practicing these principles in my home, occupation, affairs? And I let others see me for who I am. And in that way, my words have more depth and weight. Never watch the way a person talks. Always watch the way they walk. And with that, thanks for keeping me sober.